Kids These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Today on the program, we're untying the knot. Divorce is pretty common these days. In fact, in the United States, about half of all first marriages end in divorce, and that number is higher for second and third unions. So we'll explore the emotional side of dissolving a partnership with experts, hear the voices of adult children of divorced parents, and revisit the legalities of marriage in the 49th state. Plus, what happens if there's a history of abuse when parents split? All that and more this hour on Kids These Days. Hello, I'm Shanna Sheehy, host of Kids These Days. The institution of marriage is just that, an institution with roots going back to prehistory. The prevalence of divorce, though, that's something fairly new in our culture. And while not all divorces include children, many do. What emotional issues are families working through? What about logistics? Who gets the kids for the holidays, for example? Well, what do you think, and what's your experience? How do you cope with the challenges of divorce? Tell us. Email your comments to mail@kidsthesedays.org, that or chime in through Facebook or directly on our website. Divorce and helping children through it, that's our topic today. And here to help me with that are two distinguished guests. Christina McGee is an internationally acclaimed divorce coach and parent educator. She's devoted her career to helping children and families successfully manage the challenges of divorce. She's written about this subject in her book, Parenting Apart: How Separated and Divorced Parents Can Raise Happy and Secure Kids. She joins us by phone from her home in Texas. Thanks to you, Christina, for being with us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
With me in the studio is Al Levy. Al Levy is a therapist in private practice in Anchorage. He focuses on children, families, parenting, and relationships. He does court-ordered family therapy, co-parenting counseling, expert witness testimony, and custody investigations as part of his practice. He is also an adjunct faculty member at UAA, the University of Alaska Anchorage, teaching psychology. He has a particular interest in psychology and the law. Al, thanks to you for being with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, since we're talking about divorce today and how we can help children navigate through a divorce or come out of a divorce, as the title of your book, Christina, says, Happy and Secure, maybe that's just a great place to begin the conversation. It's a huge question to get started with, but how do we embark on that journey to get through a divorce and have children who are happy and secure at the end of it?
Well, I think a lot of it, Shanna, has to do with our perceptions and how we manage the event. I mean, the two biggest factors in how children will fare through a divorce is, one, how mom and dad are handling it, and the level of parent conflict that exists. I mean, kids simply don't do well when there is a lot of tension and fighting and hostility going on between mom and dad. So if parents can really separate their emotions from their children's experience, let their needs take a back seat and really stay focused on their kids, trying to minimize that conflict, you know, you're headed in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. And Al Levy, what might you add to that?
I would just have to second what Christina has said, that divorce in and of itself, although it's unfortunate if it happens, what's toxic in divorce isn't the divorce per se, it's the parents' reactions, it's the conflict and the hostility between the parents that creates toxicity for the children.
Okay, so conflict. You guys are both experienced with this. So how would you say is a pretty common way that conflict between divorcing parents is seen by kids?
Well, they see it. They see the parents fighting. They'll see the parents arguing, saying in worst cases, they'll see really bad behaviors between their parents. But even in cases where parents are trying really hard not to expose the children to the conflict, children can pick up on the emotional states of their parents. And children particularly in the younger the children are, the more they are working on the stage where they're developing emotional regulation. That is, that they're learning to develop the internal controls on their own emotions. And during the younger stages, they look to the adults around them to essentially help them regulate their own emotions. So whatever level of emotion they perceive in their parents, and it's not by the parents' words or what they're saying, it's something a little more subtle. The children pick up on the parents' level of emotional intensity, and they use that to adjust their own level of emotional intensity, safety, and so on. Mm-hmm. So the parents have to really work really hard on calming themselves down to help their children calm down.
That sounds difficult if you are, you know, a spouse and you're divorcing this person who has been in your life for however long. What are some practical tips? Maybe you can answer this, Christina. How can parents keep themselves calm and regulate those emotions in order to help themselves and then, of course, their children?
Well, I think a big part of that is engaging in good self-care. You know, more often than not when we're going through this process, and I think this is something that all parents struggle with, not just parents going through separation and divorce, and that is acknowledging our own needs. Mm-hmm. You know, usually we're worried about, you know, how are we going to manage the mortgage and still have enough money to, you know, maybe hire a lawyer, and what are we going to do about the schedule, and, you know, Billy's got music lessons, and am I going to still be able to afford that, and the project I've got going on at work, you know, how am I going to balance those hours with picking up the kids after school? And so we've got all these things, and what we do is we put ourselves at the bottom of the list.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, we're not going to be able to offer our kids our very best. We are not at our parenting best when we're exhausted, we haven't eaten, you know, we're not taking time to put energy into ourselves. So all those things, I mean, I think fundamentally that's kind of the cornerstone that also plays a really big part in how we handle things emotionally. You know, emotionally, if we're not taking care of our needs, if we don't have good supports outside of our immediate family, people that we trust that we can talk to who aren't going to fuel the fire, but are going to help us gain some perspective and some insight, then what's going to happen is those emotional boundaries get blurred, and we run the risk of thinking how I feel about divorce is how my kids feel about divorce. So it really is very important for parents to tap in to some kind of support system for themselves, not just physically and mentally, but also emotionally.
Will you explain that point a little bit more, the risk involved in having parents assume that the way that they're feeling about a divorce is the same way that their children are feeling it about a divorce?
Well, very often when parents aren't taking care of themselves emotionally, they're not paying attention to their feelings, it's a slippery slope. You know, maybe there was infidelity in the relationship, and you hear, you know, parents might say things like, well, look how he let us down, or she betrayed us, or she doesn't love us anymore. And so they start talking collectively and assuming that their children's experience is the same as theirs, when in reality, more often than not, children's experience of divorce and their feelings about divorce are very different than their parents. And it's, you know, you need to remember that the quality of the marriage relationship doesn't determine the quality of the parent-child relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so while your ex may have been a really lousy spouse, it doesn't mean they can't be a great parent.
Al Levy, do you see that in your practice? Do you see both, you know, kids and adults and having them have very different feelings related to what's going on with the divorce?
Well, I have to say it's a very gratifying experience to have a sense of having like minds looking at the same problem that Christine is using very similar words to the ones I use. The children absolutely have a very different experience of the divorce than the parents are having, and that the an essential key in having a good divorce, and it is possible to have a good divorce, is the self-care element. It's one of the things I'll tell parents is it's like the lecture you get when you're about to take off in an airplane, and they tell you when the oxygen masks come down, put yours on first. And so parents have to learn a certain degree of healthy selfishness. They have to take care of themselves first. And this applies whether they're in a divorce or they're in a stable relationship. They have to take care of themselves first. They have to have enough oxygen in their brains to be able to take care of those around them. So that self-care element is really important. And the next is getting some perspective. To separate your emotions, what your inner experience is of the situation from what, say, a camera might record in the experience, and that you, recognizing that your experience is going to be different than your children's experience, and your experience is going to be different than the person on the other side of you, that ex-spouse. You're all in the same, perhaps in the same physical location at the same exact time, but each of you are going to have a very different description of events because your experience of it is different. And that's really key to understanding what's going on and also key to minimizing the conflict and moving towards a positive solution.
Now, you mentioned just now a good divorce, and I read a paper that you wrote that talks, it's titled A Good Divorce, and in it, you mentioned that 10% of divorces take up 90% of the court's time.
Yes.
Explain that.
The divorces we hear about are the worst case scenarios. They're dramatic. They command a lot of attention. Many of us know families or friends or maybe unfortunately have experienced that. These kind of high conflict, intense divorces where parents are literally spending tens of thousands of dollars bankrupting themselves and the conflict just seems never ending. Those divorces are really relatively small in percentage, but they take up an inordinate amount of time in the courts and an inordinate amount of resources among the families that are caught up in it. Most divorces settle relatively quickly. It's the unusual and high conflict cases that sometimes are driven by domestic violence, driven by psychological issues in one or both parents, or sometimes just people get caught up in something. In a few cases, they get the wrong lawyer, or they get misguided help from people who've been in a high conflict divorce and have their own agenda. So there's a lot of complexity in how these 10% of cases end up taking up 90% of the time, but they do command a lot of time. People fighting over some pretty extreme things that other people wouldn't think to fight over. Whether it's who gets the train set or who gets the silverware, or when daylight saving times comes, you got an extra hour, so I want an extra hour. All kinds of things like that suddenly become things to fight about when emotions get that high.
Christina McGee, the idea of a good divorce, is that something that when you're coaching and speaking and writing, is that a concept that you write about and believe in?
Absolutely. I mean, I believe that there's a lot of reason for hope, and I completely agree with Al's perspective that, the number of divorces that can't get to that good place is relatively small in percentage. That I think for the vast majority of parents, if they can get connected to good information and supports early on in the process, they're going to be less likely to hit those pitfalls that we're talking about, where there's a lot of conflict and tension. And I encourage parents, even in situations where you maybe don't have a cooperative ex, or maybe your ex is in a completely different emotional state, because you do go through stages. And as Al said, we're all going through it at the same time and kind of physically in the same place, but everyone may be in a very different emotional part of the process. And so if you don't have an ex that's quite there yet or you can't work it out, there's still a lot of things that you can do. Kids are going to fare far better if one parent gets it together than if nobody gets it together. So even in those circumstances, take heart, there's things you can still do.
You're listening to Kids These Days on your locally supported public radio station. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm talking with Alaska counselor Al Levy and Texas author Christina McGee this hour about divorce and the way caring adults can help children through it. Well, for this week's show, we wanted to hear from some children of divorced parents. So we sought out adults whose parents split when they were kids. What do they say now about how the experience affected them? We spoke with four people, ranging in age from 30 to mid-50s, and found a range of experiences, from saying they were quite traumatized to feeling pretty matter-of-fact about it.
My name is Debbie, and I'm 53 years old. and a school teacher. And my parents divorced when I was in my early 20s. I had just finished college. I had two younger sisters. One younger sister had just completed high school, and the other one was just entering middle school. The impact it had was significant. It's certainly one of the defining moments in my life, even though I was out of college and pretty much on my own. And I think it had a lot to do with the fact that there was not a lot of communication amongst ourselves or with other people about what was going on with regard to the divorce. My mom never really did process the divorce. She died about a year and a half ago. And there was always a great deal of anger. And I wish that she'd had the opportunity to kind of deal with some of that anger and maybe would have been a little bit happier in the later parts of her life. My father went on to marry another woman, much younger woman, and wound up having another four children. My relationship with my father, although not very close before the divorce, really deteriorated afterwards. None of the three daughters have really been able to reestablish a quality relationship with him, and not really a quality relationship with the rest of his family, that his second family. I think we all would have been better off and been able to deal with things much better if we had had the opportunity for counseling. And I think that no matter how old we are, there's great value in having that core stability of your family, your parents together, always there in your life, no matter how old you get.
I was 5 years old when my parents divorced. I was explaining that mommy and daddy still love you, but we're going to live in separate houses now. So that explanation didn't mean that they didn't love each other. And I never remember them bickering in front of me or fighting. Maybe I was asleep or when they did it, but I don't remember them fighting. So I think that helped. It had a huge impact on me. I was raised by two separate people. My father was working all the time. So, you know, my mother was very homebody. So, it was just different seeing them separate and then actually living with them being not together. I think the best thing that my parents did was never fight in front of me. They never said anything poorly about one another. I don't remember my mother ever saying, "Oh, your father," and going on that lecture, or your mother, I can't believe her. I don't remember any of that. I think that they need to work on their issues separately and keep the children in mind.
I was about three. You know, I think when my parents got separated that my dad had to settle into a new place. I remember him having an apartment and getting an Atari. I remember going to my dad's house and him doing a lot to try to make things enjoyable. I think that he was trying to buffer the negative experience that went along with the divorce. And I think my mom did the same thing. I think she tried to do a lot of fun things, but then I think she also got stuck with most of the day-to-day effort of raising a child. Early on, they weren't together very much, but as I got older and started getting into activities like playing baseball, I remember them both being at games and both filling various roles. So my mom always had coolers of things to feed the team, and my dad coached a lot of the teams that I was on. My mom's side of the relationship, I was reared in the mountains in a rural environment. There was a lot to do with horses and hunting and hiking. And then my dad's environment was much more in the city and a little bit more upper middle class. There was a lot of television and electronics and computers in particular, which turned out to be good for me because I work in information technology. And so I think probably one of the positive experiences is the diversity that I got of rearing, in that even now today in my adult life I enjoy outdoor things, but then my profession is based on computers. So I think I got two families, if you will.
I was in first grade, whatever that is, seven, something like that. I remember there being a decreased level of stress post divorce for sure. And my parents both got remarried like within 6 months of getting divorced, so it was still a lot of family around. And we still saw my dad regularly. He lived in the same town, so we saw him on the weekends and Christmas. And even after he moved away a couple of years later, we still spent Christmas and summer vacations at his house. My dad and I remember my dad and my stepmom staying at our house when they came from out of town over the holidays. And so my mom and my stepdad and my dad and my stepmom would all stay under the same roof. And, you know, they didn't hang out together and play poker every Wednesday or anything like that. But they definitely never said anything bad about each other in front of the kids and tried to be, I mean, they were very adult about it. And now I didn't think it was a big deal at the time, but after seeing other things now, I am very grateful for that. Children of, someone told me, I don't know, some time, children of divorced parents are much more likely to be divorced themselves. And for a while that really bothered me, you know, I felt like it was a stigma, or that's not going to happen to me. But, you know, I guess I feel like having a happy marriage is much more important than how many times you've been married or divorced.
Devin Roberts, Sarah Gonzalez, and Jessica Cochran collected those voices for us today. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm speaking with Al Levy and Christina McGee today about divorce. I'd like to invite both of you guys to make comments about some of the things we heard those adult children of divorced parents talking about. Al?
Well, one of the things that strikes me about it is I appreciate the diversity of experiences that your people were able to collect. Because in my work, what I always remember is that every divorce is somebody's individual story, and that you have to be really careful not to stereotype or put people into particular categories. Every divorce, every person's experience is their own unique experience. There's certain common patterns that emerge, and you can see the diversity of experience where some of the people reported just very negative outcomes, that it turned their life for the worse, and for others it turned their life for the better. So there's so many variables involved that you have to avoid making sweeping generalizations about divorce. Mm-hmm. That it's an individual choice, and that there are individual and very unique circumstances in every case.
Christina McGee, your website, childrenanddivorce.com, you have an article that folks can read about do's and don'ts during a divorce. One thing that I noticed as we were listening to that piece is that there were quite a few things that those adults reported that were on the do list and also on the don't list. I wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, I think when I heard, and, you know, as Al said, I appreciate the diversity of the comments, and there is, you know, no cookie cutter solution, but the themes that really popped out for me is this idea of continuing to be a family. You know, divorce doesn't end family life for children, it changes family life. And instead of being a family in one home, kids have a family in two homes. And what's most important for kids is to feel that sense of connection and belonging. You know, one of the things I talk about in my book and I frequently discuss with parents is the need to support a two-home concept, that really, regardless of how children are spending time with each parent, they feel a psychological, emotional connection, a sense of belonging. They continue to be a family with each parent, and how really critical that is for kids.
Mm-hmm. I remember on going back to your website, childrenanddivorce.com, in that don't column, one of the things that stood out to me there that we did hear, at least one of those people talking about, was the idea that parents who are divorcing shouldn't try to get children on one person's side or the other, or to sort of villainize the other spouse or the ex-spouse. Could you comment on that as well, that dynamic that can happen, the parent alienation, I believe you call it?
Yes, parent alienation really has to do with a parent. You know, earlier we talked about the need to separate your own experiences and feelings from the needs of your kids. Parent alienation is all about a parent committing themselves to really destroying the relationship between the child and the other parent. So it's kind of a you're either for me or against me mentality, and they literally put kids in a position where they must pick or choose. One parent is all bad and one parent is all good. And so what happens is kids are put in this very difficult position where they really have to decide. So a lot of times it ends up in them rejecting a parent. And it can absolutely level you when you've had this formerly loving relationship with your child and all of a sudden you're hearing things like, I don't want to see you anymore, don't talk to me, you're a liar, I hate you. Mm-hmm. And parents are really caught off guard by that. But those kind of dynamics play out in very subtle ways too, where it's not to the extent of parent alienation, but it is putting kids in a position where they have to pick or choose, telling kids, you know, who do you want to spend Christmas with?
Mm.
Who do you want to live with? Who do you want to spend the most time with?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that puts kids, because in order to accept one parent, they have to reject the other.
That sounds like a very, very difficult position to be in as a young person.
It's a psychologically and emotionally impossible position. And that's why it's so important for parents to be on their best behavior. My advice to parents when they're dealing with difficult situations is that they tell their children to be a good child to the other parent no matter what. That the parents teach the children to be good children of the other parent. So even if you have a very difficult ex-spouse on the other side, the advice to the children is you still have to be a good son or daughter to them. You have to be respectful. You have to be obedient to the rules in their home when they're there. This is leaving aside any issues about abuse or safety or other kind of things, but just the kind of emotional conflicts that arise. And what I advise parents, is, particularly in the early stages of the divorce, if the children are young, that this approach really pays dividends later. Because if the child knows that you are telling them, be a good child to your other parent, then the child will feel safe coming to you with complaints about the other parent, knowing you're not going to take them and run to court and use it against them. So there's a kind of betrayal that goes on if you are not being an advocate for the child to be a good son or daughter to the other difficult parent, because they still love that parent and they're looking for help. They're really looking for help to that question. How do I be a good son or daughter? How do I deal with them? And they can't trust you for help on that if they know that you're going to use that against the other parent, and which is ultimately being used against the child.
Right. Well, Kids These Days is produced and distributed by the Content Producers Guild with help from our media partners, KSKA FM Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. We want to extend a warm welcome to our new listeners in Haines and Skagway who now hear Kids These Days weekly on KHNS. KHNS joins a growing family of KTD stations, including KDLG Dillingham, KTOO Juno, KRUA FM, as well as KSKA Anchorage and its translator communities. Still to come this hour, we learn about what happens in divorce when there's a history of violence. I'm back with guests Christina McGee and Al Levy. And we listen back to attorney Stephen Pradell, who wrote the Alaska Family Law Handbook. He joined Kids These Days earlier this year to talk about legal issues related to divorce and dissolution. Stay with us. We'll be back with that and more after a quick break.
Oh, I'd rather rest the soul lie down. Life for a while with you here against the earth. And you hear your sister sleep talking, say your hair is long but not long enough to reach her to me. But your beard someday might be. And she woke up in a cold sweat on the floor next to a family portrait drawn when you were four, and beside a jar of 2 cent coins that are no good no more. She lay aside. Back to the home you made on the mountainside with
Has it happened to you at the store? Your kid is nagging and nagging and you break down and just buy that thing they've got to have? That's the scene many marketers are betting on. And it's the topic of conversation next time on Kids These Days. We'll learn about how our kids are marketed to and what strategies we can use to help kids be media savvy. That and more next time. We're back. You're tuned in to Kids These Days on listener-supported public radio across Alaska. I'm Shanna Shee, and counselor Al Levy and author Christina McGee join me today to discuss divorce and how to navigate it for couples, children, family, and community. Before we get back to that conversation, we have this. Aside from all the emotional issues wrapped up in a divorce, there are some technical legal issues too, like custody, child support, and visitation. Earlier this year, Kids These Days spoke with Anchorage family law attorney Stephen Pradel about common legal issues for families. Here's the author of the Alaska Family Law Handbook.
My book is probably more of a custody book than anything else. People who go through divorces have other issues. They have issues that deal with property division and other things. But most of the time, we're talking about what's best for children, and we call that the best interest of the child. And there's some side issues, and most issues also have child support components and, you know, who has the PFD and all the sort of secondary issues. But mostly it's where should kids live and how much time should kids spend with each parent or whomever ends up being the person that the court decides is best for the child.
So can you maybe tell us a little bit about the law with respect to custody? I read that there are maybe two, maybe more different kinds of custody. There's shared custody and sole custody. Are those as easy as they seem in terms of the words that we use to describe those?
Well, the words are very complicated, and they mean different things in different contexts. There's basically two kinds of custody from one approach, and that is legal custody versus physical custody. And physical custody means, where do kids live? Do the children live equally with each parent? Are they sharing physical custody? Or does the child live primarily with one parent? And depending on how many overnights they have, it's sole custody. And it's all kind of intertwines with the child support amount too, because it's based in a sense on where do kids sleep at night and how much time are they spending with each parent. And the second type of custody, aside from physical custody, is legal custody. And what that means mostly is who makes the decisions about the children? Do we make them together, two parents? Do they talk about it and both have an equal say? Or does one parent have sole legal custody, which means that they get to decide where a child goes to school, which doctors the child sees, whether they have braces or a tattoo or get a bar mitzvah or baptism? There are major decisions in children's lives, and sharing legal custody is preferred, but parents really have to communicate well in order for a court to find that it's in the best interest.
And so is it possible then to have there be physical custody for one parent, but then legal custody of another parent? Does that ever happen?
You know, lots of different things happen, and I was in a case that I can remember where a judge gave legal custody to one parent and physical custody to the other. So yes, there's no requirement that one travels with the other.
And so explain for me also, you know, why is it the case? I think you said, I should paraphrase you and tell me if this is right, but in most cases it's best to have it be shared legal custody between two parents. You know, why does the Alaska court system feel that that's the case?
Well, the court system gets its marching orders from the legislature, and the Alaska legislature has said on different occasions that it feels that both parents should, as long as it's practicable and it's not bad for the children, not detrimental to their best interest in the legal terminology, that parents should share custody as much as they can. It's not always possible. Alaska is a big state. We have people living thousands of miles away from each other in this one state, and then the lower 48 and other parts of the world. So that can't always happen. But to the extent that it works, shared custody, shared physical custody, generally is in the best interest of children.
So let's do a little bit of time traveling. Like, let's imagine, I mean, we're talking about a judge deciding matters of custody, physical custody, legal custody. But if we travel back in time to, you know, a particular family and when they might start the process that brings them to that point, what kinds of disputes are in play when you end up in front of a judge talking about the custody of your children? Like, how does a family get there?
Well, you can resolve your issues in a number of ways. If you're married and are thinking about getting a divorce, you can either go to court and have somebody else decide everything for you, which isn't always best, or you can try to figure it out yourself. And there's a form that you can get from the court that's called a dissolution form, and they're available online too, and this may be a good time to talk about the Alaska Family Law Self-Help Center. It's a relatively new development in Alaska. It's a very helpful place where you can find it by Googling it, and there's lots of forms, and there's people that can answer procedural questions. It's a branch of the court system where people are there that are trained to help people, guide them through the process. They're not lawyers, or even if they are, they're not allowed to give legal advice, but they are allowed to help people pick the right form and understand what a court proceeding is like, and offer them tips on how to prepare their case for trial. So going back to your question, if parents are able to communicate well, they can either do a dissolution if they are married, and if they're not married, they can come up with some kind of a custody agreement. There's a model parenting agreement that a Fairbanks judge created. It's about 25 pages long. It's got some instructions which are helpful, and it kind of goes through many of the issues that parents have, and it gives them three or four different choices, and if they can't figure out which one's the right one, they can write their own. And that's another way of sort of getting educated and working with somebody else to try to resolve your issues. If you can't do it, and oftentimes people get to a deadlock and they can't figure it out, that's where a judge comes in. Judges are available to hear cases, and they hear probably more custody kinds of cases than any other kind of case. Believe it or not, they may not like it, but that's our caseload is pretty full of custody matters, and the family law lawyers in Anchorage and in Alaska stay pretty busy.
We'll link to the Alaska Family Law Self-Help Center that Stephen referenced, as well as Alaska Legal Services. They offer free clinics on divorce and custody. You can also find Stephen's Alaska Family Law Handbook online. All those links and more are there for you at kidsthesedays.org. You're listening to Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm joined by Christina McGee and Al Levy today to talk about divorce and how we help ourselves and our kids get through it. Al, I'd like to invite you first to comment on what we just heard Stephen Pradel talking about.
Steve's very articulate, and he said it all very well. It's important for people to understand that when you step into court, you're stepping into a very different world where words that have casually, generally understood meanings in everyday life have very specific meanings in court. And that when people step into court, essentially they're putting decisions in the hands of somebody else. The family court in particular exists for the purpose of making decisions that people can't make for themselves. And so people need to go in there with that understanding, and sometimes they're looking for something else. Vindication, resolution, they're looking for closure, they're looking for, you know, the sort of kind of decisive ruling that you'd get in an episode of Law and Order. I want him found guilty. And that's not what family court is for. Family court is to make decisions that people otherwise would be able to make for themselves. And so it's important to understand that. And then when you get into questions of like best interest, we use that all the time. Well, it's the best interest of my kid to sign up for this baseball league. When you step into court and you talk about best interest, it goes from being a general idea, this sort of vague idea about enhancing the growth and nourishing the well-being of children, to something very specific that's identified in 9 specific points of law. And so being that precise and that legalistic is something that most people aren't used to being, and it's a little mind-boggling for them when they're confused by a judge's ruling or by the fact that the judge apparently didn't see something that seems obvious to everybody. So I could go on for a while, but I'll stop.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying emotionally for a family, it can really be best to take care of things as best you can outside of the court in the first place and try not to get there for the emotions of the whole family. Is that
That's one way to put it. Another way I would put it is that decisions people make for themselves generally are better and have a higher chance of succeeding than decisions that are made for them. That would be another way to put it.
Right, right. Christina McGee, might you have a response?
Well, I agree with what Al said and the information that was shared, and then that court isn't a place to resolve emotional issues. You know, a lot of times parents are looking for things to be fair and equal, and in a divorce there are, you know, there aren't winners and losers. Everybody loses something. So that day in court that you've been waiting for, more often than not, is very disappointing and shallow. And when you leave decisions up to the court system, you know, you really kind of trying to take a plan and make your children's lives fit somebody else's plan for them. It's not a good long-term option. And if you're really interested in creating a plan that's in your children's best interest, you have more power, more flexibility, and you're going to come up with a better outcome when you can find some way to work together.
We've talked a lot so far about the places where it's not a good idea for couples who are divorcing to be emotional. It's not a good idea for them to be emotional in the court system or to take their emotional issues to the courts. It's not a good idea for them to express their emotions in front of or to their children in certain ways that might cause the kids to have a harder time with the divorce. Where is the right place for couples who are divorcing, who I imagine are going through, in many cases, of course, not all, extreme emotional distress? Where is the right place for them to be expressing emotion and getting help of that nature?
May I speak to that?
Yes, Al.
Well, I start with the principle that feelings are to be felt but not acted on. So whatever you're feeling, you have to not let them become marching orders, imperatives that I feel like doing, you know, you make me so mad, I feel like doing something bad to you, so therefore I'm going to do it. Feelings are to be felt and not acted on. What are feelings for? They're to be expressed. So you need a healthy, safe place to express those emotions to clear your head so that the rational part of your brain can take over and make good decisions. So a therapist, a good friend who doesn't have their own psychological agenda to manipulate you into, you know, doing something. Somebody who is a good listener, a good friend who will look you in the eye and tell you when you're wrong. And you can trust them to do that. So those are the kind of places. You need a place to vent. In that article of mine that you mentioned before, in having a good divorce, I advise parents to, if they have to communicate by email, write two emails. The first one, say all the things you want to say exactly the way you want to say it. Get it off your chest, vent, vent, vent. And then when you're done, delete it. Or share it with a friend. Don't read it to your kids, but, you know, express it somewhere safe where it's contained and, you know, allowed out but doesn't do any harm. So when you got that out, then you write the second email, which just has the information that needs to be communicated, that's just strictly business. I used to like the old Dragnet TV show with Joe Friday, and you'd always hear him say, just the facts. And you want to be that sort of just the facts. You want to have a little bit of politeness in there. You want to be diplomatic, but you leave out all of the emotional decorations and trappings and venting. That's for the first email that you should never send.
You know, you mentioned email, Al Levy, mm-hmm. and I think, Christina, on your website that I've mentioned, I found some references to communicating by email as well. So I'm wondering, is this technology, which isn't necessarily new at all anymore, but it is a fast and effective technology, is email a really great way to have communication with an ex-partner? Just ask that.
Yes and no. Yes, because it avoids the stimulation that you get from seeing that person face to face. It allows you a little bit of distance. It allows you some time to coolly think about what you're saying and what you're doing. The downside of it is that our brains have a tendency to fill in the blanks. So when you're reading the email that person sent you, there's a tendency to project onto it a tone of voice. To hear in the words something that may not have been intended by the writer. And so sometimes I've seen email exchanges get blown out of proportion because people have projected a tone of voice and emotion into it that may not have been there, but it's a product of their own inner emotional turmoil. So people need to be very clear in themselves about that. That's the risk of the emails, is that lacking the tone of voice, the expressive punctuation, if you will, we assume a tone of voice that's in there, and sometimes that causes a reaction.
You know, Christina McGee, I'm changing the subject slightly here. Before we got underway in this conversation, you mentioned that you are a bonus mom and that you're also the child of divorce yourself. And I hoped you could explain, first off, what the term bonus mom means and how you use it.
Well, bonus language is an alternative to using step, stepmom, stepkids. In my family, we didn't like step language very much. I have a great relationship with my bonus kids. And bonus, by definition, is kind of an added plus. It's an unexpected advantage, if you will. And so I consider the kids in our family a plus to my life, and that's why we use the word bonus. So I think language is really important, and, you know, when we get connected into the legal system, words like custody and visitation and possession and all of those kind of words get used, and we have a tendency to adopt those, but those words are really powerful. And I encourage parents to change the way they talk about time and about relationships, because I think that impacts kids' perspective about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering about when it's right for the family for a parent who has divorced the other parent to start pursuing new partner relationships, dating, that kind of thing. Like, what is there any kind of general advice that can be given about how much time is the right amount of time, or, you know, what kind of situation does your family life need to be in now that there are two households, or whatever the situation is, before you start dating? Christina?
Well, I think the clock starts ticking for everybody a little bit differently, and that's a very personal choice to make. I always encourage parents to make sure that you've had time to heal, that you've, you know, taken a look at what you need to do to get back to that whole person before entering another relationship, because a lot of times we feel a sense of emptiness. There's a void that the marriage had filled, and we want to fill it really quickly. We think, oh, I just married the wrong person, so now that I'm, you know, getting a relationship with the right person, things are going to be okay. So I think you definitely need to take your time. And I also really encourage parents to think about at what point you get kids involved in the picture. And my guiding rule is, when a relationship has moved beyond casual dating, your kids have had time to adjust to the idea of mom and dad being in different homes, you know, maybe then you can start thinking about it. If you want to date before then, feel free to do so. You can let your kids know, but you don't engage them in that process.
Mm-hmm. Al, might you have recommendations?
I agree with what Christina said. I would, based on your original question, I would take the issue of time out of it, because time could be a misleading factor. Mm-hmm. That just saying, well, I've been divorced for a year, so I'm okay to start dating. That it's really more about the things you need to be looking at are other factors that time may be an element in, but time will mislead you away from really looking at what's most important. And what's really most important is clarity in your own mind. Making sure that issues are resolved in your life, that are you in a position to assume the benefits and burdens of a new relationship? If you've got protracted custody litigation going on and you're experiencing all of the stresses attendant with that, it's not a good idea to start a new relationship, although it's very tempting to do that, because you need support, you need a sympathetic ear. So making sure your life is in order and that you're on solid enough ground to manage all of the pluses and minuses of a new relationship is really more important than just how much time has elapsed. Mm-hmm. Some people, and because every divorce is different, some people are already ready for a relationship before they've gotten out of the old one. I mean, that marriage is been dead to some extent, but you got to make sure your house is in order before you bring the guests in.
Well, I think it's a great time to hear this. Co-parenting successfully with anyone after a separation or divorce can be challenging. After all, there's a reason the parents got divorced in the first place. But in cases where there has been violence in a relationship, it can be more than tough. It can be dangerous. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran has more for us on that today.
University of Illinois researcher Jennifer Hardesty studies intimate family relationships and violence. For one study, in 2009, she conducted in-depth interviews with mothers who had divorced after experiencing abuse in their marriages. She was trying to determine the kind of violence they experienced and how things were going post-divorce.
Intimate terrorism is basically when violence is just one tactic among many that an abuser uses to maintain dominance and control over their partner. So they may be violent, but they may also monitor her whereabouts, restrict her use of money, and different tactics like that. Versus situational couple violence is with instances in which a couple is having an argument that escalates into violence. Say, for example, there's an argument over an affair or argument over money, and it escalates into a violent incident, but it's not an overall pattern of the relationship in which one person is trying to control the other.
Not surprisingly, those who experienced situational violence are more able to co-parent and negotiate with their former partners after the strong feelings associated with the separation subside. Those families may respond well to traditional interventions like parenting classes or anger management and be optimistic about their ability to co-parent. But those who have experienced intimate terrorism report still feeling threatened and manipulated after their divorce and being less able to focus on parenting. Hardesty says in those cases,
interventions that focus on helping parents cooperate might not be the safest. So I think interventions should instead focus on safety as the priority, minimizing the potential for ongoing violence and control through custody arrangements that limit contact, limit the need for the two parents to have to negotiate different issues on a repeated basis. To have conditions that the abuser, for example, complete better intervention, substance abuse treatment, whatever's necessary, and also services for the victim of abuse to help her manage parenting and to address the needs of children who have been exposed to violence. So I think that with intimate terrorism, it just presents a situation where comprehensive and more long-term type services are necessary if we want the parents to be able to both stay involved in the child's life, in the children's lives, in a healthy way.
Hardesty says her research shows that in most situations, women do want their kids to have a relationship with their fathers, even when violence has been present. Christine McLeod-Pate agrees that there are different kinds of violence. She heads the Legal Advocacy Project at the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Alaska law doesn't distinguish between the types, and it can be hard to prove the type of violence in court. Alaska law was revised in 2004, putting domestic violence at the forefront of a judge's decision about determining child custody.
The legislature passed what's called a rebuttable presumption, saying that a parent who has committed one act of domestic violence that creates serious physical injury, or more than one act of domestic violence, should presumptively not be given sole legal or shared legal or primary physical or shared physical custody of their child unless they do certain things to rebut that presumption, which is they're supposed to do a batterer's program, not be abusing substances, and the court has to find that it's in the children's best interest for them to be involved as a custodial parent.
The laws are written to help victims leave a violent situation. Often, threats about taking the kids away keep them in a relationship. Pate says for the most part, Alaska's laws are strong enough, but she'd like to see better enforcement and more legal representation in court for victims. We'll have the links to some sources of free legal help on our website, kidsthesedays.org. I'm Jessica Cochran.
Al Levy, I'd like to invite you to comment because I know that you have some experience in this area, don't you?
Yes. I do sometimes offer expert witness testimony in regard to domestic violence. And this is another one of those areas where there's a difference between the meaning of domestic violence in the law, in the general understanding of domestic violence, or in the general understanding of domestic violence is, you know, if we're looking at, you know, just in the general population, there's a tremendous amount of misinformation and lack of knowledge about what domestic violence is. And your speaker talked about two types of domestic violence. And it's really important to understand that there are, that domestic violence comes in different types with significantly different impacts and different meanings in terms of safety, impact on the children, and so on. In a clinical sense of domestic violence, of one person, you know, using violence or emotions or words or manipulation to abuse another person, I could say, for example, that this person is abusive or this person has been abused, but if I go into court to testify about it, that may not rise to the legal definition, the legal standard of what domestic violence is. So it's important to understand that the definitions are different, you know, when even though we're using the same words. Mm-hmm. And another problem with it is that using the word domestic violence puts too much attention on the violence aspect of it and not enough on the other coercive control elements of it. Because you can have somebody who is using what was described as intimate terrorism, who has done very little or almost no violence per se, but is using all of the tactics of coercive control, the threat of violence, the threat of taking away your children, control over finances, control over all these other things, so that the person is in a position of being literally terrorized and controlled by this other person, but without some graphic, distinct act of violence as described in the law, you won't get a judicial finding of domestic violence. So this is a very tricky, difficult, and challenging area that we should probably spend a whole series of shows on.
Right, very challenging. Well, Christina McGee, might you be able to give some advice to a parent out there listening today who is about to begin this process of divorce and has all the concerns that would go along with that? What is some advice that you would offer to that person as they are about to start the process?
I would say focus on the big picture. You know, when you look back on this time in your life, you know, when you're going through it, everything feels and seems larger than life. And it's very easy to get into that place of being reactive instead of thoughtfully responding. And so I encourage parents sometimes when they're needing a perception check to think back, you know, 5 years from now, what will help you feel proud about how you handled the divorce? 5 years from now, what difference are the choices you're making today going to make in your children's lives? So you really want to kind of look at it from a long-term perspective and to really do in some way, shape, or form, get connected with support and information, whether it's talking to a counselor, a trusted friend, reading a book, attending a support group, but find some way to get connected so that you can make the best possible choices in the beginning stages, because that can really shape the journey for you and your kids.
Well, that's a great place to leave it, and that is all the time that we have today. I'd like to thank both of you so much for being with us here on Kids These Days. Christina McGee is a divorce coach, speaker, and author of Parenting Apart, How Separated and Divorced Parents Can Raise Happy and Secure Kids, and she joined us today from her home in Texas. Thanks again, Christina.
My pleasure.
And Al Levy is an Anchorage therapist in private practice at Generations of Family Place. And thank you, Al, for being with us today.
It was a pleasure being here. I enjoyed this very much.
Go to kidstheseDays.org to find direct links to Christina's work, as well as the resources mentioned throughout the hour, like Stephen Pradel's Alaska Family Law Handbook and the Alaska Family Law Self-Help Center. We're at kidstheseDays.org, or you can find us through Facebook. Kids These Days had help reporting today from Devin Roberts. Jessica Cochran is our regular contributor, assistant producer, and technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, webmaster, and business guru. Lost Lander composed our theme music. APRN's Dave Waldron consistently supports our technical needs. I'm Shanna Sheehy, your host, and I'll see you next time.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guests, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidsthesedays.org.